Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We're back.
We're back.
We're talking about The Omen.
The Orig.
The original 1976 Gregory Peck. Serious.
Very serious theatrical performance.
Scout. He's just a serious actor. So yeah. Anyway, we're doing that movie today. I'm excited to talk about it. It's one of the one of the most influential horror movies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But before we go into that, Katie, what's new with you?
Well, nothing life-changing, like some folks around here. Mm-hmm. But it's a lovely day outside.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Like, weather's been really nice lately. And so, staying daylight later, we're starting to get that kind of spring, almost summer vibe and wanting to be outside and... school's going well. My kids don't fully have like spring fever, but we are down to 7 weeks left in the school year, which is just gonna fly by.
Do you get out earlier than me?
I don't know. Our last day is on my birthday this year, June 7th.
Okay. So I think we get out the same week as you guys.
Yeah.
That Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
The day before.
But yeah, so I'm just hanging out and rocking and rolling. We've been, traveling like a handful of weekends for kids' sports and for other special events. And so this weekend it was nice to just be home and we went out to dinner Friday night. And then yesterday morning I went over to Oakland and had brunch with my friend Hillary that I hadn't seen in a long time.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, and this morning I get to come record with Meredith, who, I mean, I don't even know if I should ask you like what's new with you. Cause like, there's nothing going on, right? There's nothing new.
It's basically the most boringest month ever.
I know. So we could just skip over what's happened. New with Meredith, unless there was something you wanted to mention.
Oh yeah. Our engineer.
Oh, that guy?
That guy.
What's his name? Victor?
He tricked me into marrying him.
Are you kidding?
No, you were there.
That's right. Oh, the dresses.
You're right up front.
Yep.
Sniffling.
Yeah, sniffling away. Right. It was allergies. All those flowers. Why'd you give me so many goddamn flowers?
I don't know. No, it was a whirlwind. It was beautiful. Yeah. And my children were adorable and cute and walked me down. And it was just a lovely ceremony. And it was one of those things where it felt like everyone who was there was it. They weren't like checking off a box like, oh, I have to do this. Yeah. It was like
genuinely 100% in for this day.
Yeah, there's 100% buy-in. Everyone was excited to be there. They're not like, oh, I'm just here for the food. I'm just here for the drink. They're like, oh, I'm just so excited to be here.
I learned to dance to be here.
Yeah, I know. And we did our first dance, which was totally normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, we're just like dancing. We're like, look, this is so boring. We're being so boring. And then it turned into Thriller. Mm-hmm. And we got our Thriller jackets and everyone, a bunch of people who are participating in the secret, including Katie.
Including me.
Ran up and we did the Thriller dance. Mm-hmm. And everyone was screaming at the top of their lungs like, oh my gosh.
It was so much fun.
It was really fun. And even the flower girls came and did it too. And it was sweet. It was a blast. Yeah. So.
And we thought the weather wasn't going to cooperate, but it stayed clear and beautiful during the uncovered ceremony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the rain didn't show up until later when we were underneath the last minute tents.
Yeah. So, because it kept saying like, it's going to rain right during the ceremony. I was like, well, that's fine.
Yeah. She's like, I'm not going to worry about that because I can't control that.
I know. I'm like, whatever. We're going to get married. Mm-hmm. It's fine.
It was spectacular. It was perfect during the ceremony.
Yes.
Sun was shining. Birds were chirping.
The sun was sniffling. Shining, beating right into my eyeballs while I was trying to read. I was like, squinting my eye.
I think it says I do. I'm not sure though.
I love you. Yada yada yada.
This guy.
You're great. you're the one for me.
Oh, and I'm gonna like take the microphone back.
Sure.
I forgot that there was something new that I've been asked to do. At the beginning of the previous episode, evidently I was unkind about my husband's driving. And so after I was talking about him driving us down to Irvine for hockey.
Oh,
and how it was like I just hated the whole passing people on I-5 and all of that, and it was terrifying. And so when he listened to the episode, he didn't appreciate that very much, and he asked that I issue a retraction.
Retract
my statements. And to be fair, because I mentioned also in that episode that we were going to be taking a different car down the old I-5 to your wedding, and we did, and it was a much more pleasant drive.
That's good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Where's the gun? The gun to your head. No, I complained about Victor too. I was like, it's crazy. But then I'm like, you drive.
Yeah, so I'm not doing it.
I know what I'm doing.
I'm not doing it. I don't think you're going to kill us. So I just need to get through this. But honestly, I think a lot of it is the way that the vehicle feels, and also what I'm used to riding in now. Mm-hmm. And so the drive in the Tesla was like way less, teeth gritting.
Ooh, yeah.
I felt white-knuckled.
Yes. Yeah. I will always complain and always not drive.
Yeah.
So I've created my own hell for myself. And Victor would be like, woman, you wanted me to drive. And he is correct.
He is. Well, and now he can say, wife.
Wife? He's like, so.
You want a fresh one?
He's full. I'm going to Glock you. You like getting your bell rung? It's suddenly the 1920s bad husband and wife beating each other.
Well, when we go to Speakeasy in a couple of weeks, they can smack us around a little bit.
Yeah, because we have it coming.
Yeah, we do. We got mouthy.
We're not really. Just
yeah, no. Disclosure. Nobody that listens to this podcast would consider either of us mouthy.
Well. That's fine, but we don't get hit
for
it.
They can think what they think. Yeah, no, we don't. But yeah, to be clear, we don't get hit, and we wouldn't advocate or accept that.
True.
I don't want to have to issue another redaction next time.
Tom's like, really? He's
like, I'm like, he's a great driver, but he beats me.
I can imagine his face not appreciating this whole conversation.
Yeah, maybe okay. He'll stop listening.
Edit this out, husband.
Husband.
No, I was going to say he does a lot of my wife.
My wife.
My wife.
Oh, for Borat.
And I'm like, he's That's like, adorable. Get ready for the rest of your life.
This is my wife. He's like, this is never going to get old for me. And I'm like, ah. That's great.
Okay. So you are doing the synopsis.
I am. Yes.
Okay.
So, as Meredith mentioned, the original Omen film came out in 1976. And what year did Rosemary's Baby come out?
The late 60s, I want to say.
Yeah?
Yes.
Because I kind of look at these two films as being kind of similar projects in that they are horror movies. They do deal with supernatural elements, specifically, demonic elements. But they stylistically... 68?
Yeah.
Stylistically, I think that there's, they're kind of from the same era, but then also that idea of utilizing really skilled performers, really good actors, because then, we went through the glorious dark ages of horror movies where it was like, it's all B-listers, it's all like nobodies that can't act, and it's just girls who will take their tops off and that kind of stuff. But like, for a little while there, we had, they almost just seem like films.
Oscar-nominated performances.
Yeah, from really talented, gifted actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. And that's, what Gregory Peck brings to this film.
Yeah.
And it really takes its content very seriously. Some might, say too seriously. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Gregory Peck is the lead, the main character. And then second to him is the actor David Warner, who plays a photographer, Jennings, who is also a very notable performer. And the two of them are like, I mean, they're taking this work very seriously. This mm-hmm. isn't,
there's nothing kitschy or funny about it. It's very like, this is a crisis.
Yeah. They approach the roles and they approach the script and the story as if it were any dramatic role. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't always feel like a horror movie.
Yeah.
But anyhow, one thing that does is the opening credits. Yeah. So we see the credits over the image of, it's like the silhouette of a small boy who casts a shadow that appears as an inverted cross, accompanied by the classic now like cliche chanting in Latin that Meredith was just giving us.
South Park has ruined it forever for me. I'm like, Jay-Z Boof. I'm like, oh my God.
My sister-in-law goes, hula hoop.
It just, you know, but I understand it was made to scare you.
Right, exactly. And so I, doing this recap for the first time ever, I actually looked up what they were saying. And it is Latin. But what they're doing is they're inverting some common phrases used in mass. So one of the things they say is Ave versus Christi, which is hail Antichrist, mm-hmm. instead of hail Christ or hail Jesus. And then the other thing that they say is Corpus Santani, which is body of Satan instead of body of Christ. And so they actually are Latin phrases that mean something. It's not like an Easter egg if they're actually like names of nonsense the producers' stuff. Daughters or something. They're like Meredith, Mary Victor.
It's all supposed to be creepy if you like look into it and do a deep dive.
I feel like it is, or it was at least, like you say, now it's been hijacked by some comedic elements and also just become kind of cliche.
Yeah.
But at the time, it probably did set a very scary tone.
Yeah.
At the outset of the film.
I don't think it really had come out like that.
No.
Aside from, I mean, there's The Exorcist.
Yeah, but that didn't utilize that particular element, I don't think. I don't really remember them doing that.
No, that I mean, there's chanting. Some of the church and like, Church of Satan and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, just the Catholic elements. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so the film opens with Gregory Peck's character's name is Robert Thorne. He's in the back of a cab racing through Rome, and the screen tells us it's June 6th at 6 a.m. He's frantic, and in his head, voices echo, "The child is dead." He arrives at a hospital and wonders aloud to a priest what he should tell his wife, Catherine, who doesn't yet know that the baby she's just had is dead. The priest suggests an adoption. A nun shows Robert this sweet little infant, and he's told that the mother died in the same moment as his son died. The priest suggests that Robert's wife never be told that the baby isn't hers. Robert is hesitant, but the priest says, "On this night, God has given you a son."
Mm-hmm.
This Italian priest.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Robert goes along with this idea.
Everyone's like, how convenient. Wink, wink, wink.
Yeah. So they, you know, he presents this baby to his wife as if it is the son that she delivered herself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime later, we see Robert arriving home with the news that he's been given a new diplomatic position, the ambassador to Great Britain, and their family's moving to London.
Mm-hmm.
They move to an enormous manor house and they settle in by canoodling in the library while a nanny looks after the child. There's images of an idyllic family life, and a chat that we hear between the couple reveals that Robert's old college roommate, whom he's visiting, is now president of the United States,
mm-hmm.
as it happens. A series of still family photos shows the progression of time as the child, whose name is Damien, grows from toddler to celebrating his fifth birthday. He blows out the candles in the arms of his nanny. As you know, why would a parent want to hold their child for that moment?
Mm-hmm.
As the nanny walks away, the snarky photographer snaps a picture of her. Then weird sound effects accompany the nanny being hypnotized by a Rottweiler that's off standing beside a tree. It's like this, like almost like space age, like wah, 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 wah.
It's like,
I mean, it's not like Pink Panther. But anyway, so yeah, she catches the eyes of this dog off beside a tree, and she's hypnotized by it with these, and these sound effects are taking place. And the next thing that we know, the huge party is interrupted by the nanny calling out to Damien. We hear her say, "Look at me. I love you, Damien," before we see that she's actually standing on the edge of the roof of this huge house with a noose around her neck. She declares the iconic line, "It's all for you," before jumping and her body smashing through a huge window after the rope snaps her neck.
Which I randomly say to people.
Yeah. No, who doesn't?
Like, if there's some food left over or something and they're like, "Can I have that?" I'm like, "It's all for you." And they're like, "What's wrong with you?"
Catherine, the mother, keeps Damien facing away from the horror. But as he gazes in the other direction, he too has this like eye contact connection with the Rottweiler and then slowly waves to it.
Hi.
Hi, doggy. Hey. Okay.
Wait, what are those called? Hounds?
Hellhounds?
Hellhounds, that's it. Yeah. I was like, hellhound, devil dog. Nope, that's wrong.
Devil dog. That's like a chili dog.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, with a devil dick.
The hellhound.
Yeah. So another day, reporters are hassling Robert as he's arriving at work, asking questions about the suicide. In the hubbub, Robert bumps a photographer. Turns out it's the same snarky one from the party whose name is Jennings. So this ends up being our other primary character as the film goes on. Mm-hmm. And accidentally breaks Jennings' camera. Robert asks him to send him the bill, but Jennings says, "Let's just say you owe me." We were watching this. I have a couple notes in here of like, you know, Tom likes to make his little comments while we're watching, and he goes, "He should have said, 'Let's just say you omen me.'"
I mean, omen.
Next, Robert gets a visit upstairs in his office from Father Brennan, who is a priest from Rome. He's just told that it's something about a hospital. So Father Brennan comes in and he's just kind of ranting. "We haven't much time. You must accept Christ as your savior. You must take communion. Only if Jesus is within you can you defeat the son of the devil. He's killed once. He'll kill again. He'll kill until everything that's yours is his." So he's just like on this little tirade, to which Robert eventually says, "Fuck off," and calls security. Mm-hmm. But then Brennan, he actually like puts like a chair under the door. Can't remember. Sometimes I'm like fusing because the remake, it was very close scene for scene to the original. Yeah. And so some visuals that I have in my mind, I'm like, wait, which one was that? Mm-hmm. But anyway, Brennan is like locked the door. While the security's trying to break in, and Brennan then tells Robert that he was at the hospital the night Robert's son was born, and he says, "I saw its mother." And Robert tries to uphold the lie that Catherine is Damien's mother. And he's like, "You're referring to my wife." And he goes, I saw its mother. And then finally Brennan shouts, "His mother was a jackal," right as security breaks in. So you almost don't hear the rest of the statement. Mm-hmm. As Brennan was escorted out of the building, Jennings, who's waiting outside, takes his picture. Then we're in the dark room with Jennings, and we see him develop the picture, and he's wondering at a strange black line that's slashing into the priest's body in the photo. Like, it's like a flaw in the photo. Mm-hmm. Back at the Thorne home, a strange appearance of a Mrs. Baylock arrives to be the new nanny. She steamrolls right into the house, insisting on meeting Damien alone without the parents, which, you know, who wouldn't be comfortable with that?
She's like, "I have a tight bun in my hair. So it's pulling my eyes back. Obviously, I'm all business.
All business. No time for you." After Mrs. Baylock leaves to go meet Damien, Robert and Catherine like realize that neither of them hired this woman. They're like, "Oh, where'd you find her? I thought you found her." And so when they ask her about it, she just says, "The agency sent me." Like, oh, because nannies just fall like manna from heaven when you're a diplomat in London.
Probably.
Or maybe that's just a London thing.
I don't know.
Like you give birth to a baby and they send you home with a nanny.
All I know is Mary Poppins.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know much about that life.
Well, I worked as a nanny for a couple of years before I had my kids. And it's a strange... Well, and I wasn't a live-in nanny because mm-hmm. we were already married. Being a live-in nanny, I think, would be an even more bizarre, like an au pair experience. Because it's like you're part of the family, but you're also an employee and like you're the primary person caring for the child, but it's not your child.
Yeah.
It was odd enough to be just like a daytime nanny.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's what made me decide that when we had kids that I wanted to stay home with them, because I'd be like doing all these things with this little kid. And I was like, this is a really touching moment and it means nothing to me because you're not my child. Like, I kind of, like, I felt sad because I'm like, I wish it was your mom doing this with you right now, because to her, this would be a really sweet moment and a really sweet memory.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's me. And I'm going to be somebody that you, like, never see again in your life after I don't have this job anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, Mrs. Baylock is all in on this. She's 100%.
She's devoted her life to this.
Yes, as we'll find out. Mm-hmm. So then after she informs them, oh, the agency sent me, and they're like, okay. She then goes into Damien's room and tells him, have no fear, little one. I'm here to protect thee. And he's like, cool.
Mm-hmm.
So now's a good time to point out that Damien speaks only a few words in the entire film. Like, mm-hmm. he only speaks once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, it's just him staring.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, Katie cries, Mika comforts her. Mm-hmm. It's like Damien stares.
Damien stares.
Okay, so now Robert and Kathy are headed to a wedding. Oh, what's a fun celebratory occasion. And there's a mini power struggle between Kathy and Mrs. Baylock, who doesn't think that Damien should go with them to the wedding.
He's just going to cause too much of a fuss.
Is he going to be able to understand the nuances of an Episcopalian wedding?
But, she's like, it's not really your call.
Yeah, she's like, I don't remember asking what you thought about this. So Kathy pulls rank and the three head off in the car. But once they get close enough to the church to see the cross on top, Damien starts freaking out. Then he starts screaming and thrashing. He scratches Kathy's cheek and they're forced to drive away from the church without Kathy and Damien getting out of the car. That night, Robert muses to Kathy about how it's strange that Damien has never been sick a day in his life.
I'm like, initially, right away, I'm like, that's not how that works.
Right. But she brushes it off because she's like, it's obviously because I'm an incredible mother. I mean, come on. So then Robert, after that conversation, Robert heads down the hall toward Damien's room. He notes that the light switch in the hall isn't working before being startled by the growling coming from a Rottweiler standing outside Damien's door.
The hellhound.
And he's like, what the fuck? We don't have a dog. Mrs. Baylock comes out and says that they found the dog outside and that Damien loves him. But now it's Robert's turn to pull rank and orders Mrs. Baylock to get rid of the dog. He's like, if I decide we need a dog, I'll pick one myself. Mm-hmm. Like, you are, like, she's just really overstepping and pissing everyone off.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, listen, bitch. I am a teacup poodle man and you know it.
Pomeranians are my life. And I will not do a mangy Rottweiler from the streets.
Right. Did you pay no attention to the bumper sticker on the back of the consulate car that says, who saved who?
Who saved who?
Okay.
Continue.
Now it's time for a lovely day trip to a zoological park.
Yeah.
And this is one of the times that you hear Damien speak. He gets like an ice cream or popcorn or something from the concessions and he says thank you. And you're thank like, you. Oh my God, he has a voice.
Thank you.
But then he offers some aggressive eye contact to some giraffes and they gallop away, which I love to do at the zoo. Just glare at the animals until they leave.
Yeah. It's always fun to get a rise out of nature.
Absolutely. Next, they're off to the baboons. And so this is like an immersive park. And so they're actually driving their car through an enclosure where the animals are just loose around them. And I think it's so hilarious that this was the time in history where, like, they were just like, oh, just keep your windows up. Like, there was no security measures to make sure that visitors didn't roll down their window, didn't get out of the car, didn't whatever. Mm-hmm. And, like, baboons are dangerous animals.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just like, oh, don't forget to roll up thy window.
Don't feed the baboons.
The baboons.
Don't feed them. Baboons are dangerous.
Baboons are highly dangerous, aggressive, and territorial. Please enjoy your drive through their enclosure.
I know.
It's like, oh, so okay. You're like,
great. Sounds fun. Let's
Sounds
go.
Great. Sounds
let's
safe.
Do this.
As they're driving through the enclosure, the monkeys immediately get a little crazy, leaping on the car and terrifying Kathy and Damien. But, like, she doesn't just drive away initially. For a while, she just sits in the not moving car screaming and clutching Damien. Like, they're both screaming and holding each other when she could just drive away, which eventually is what she does.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you're supposed to drive through and stop for like a few minutes and then keep going, maybe.
Yeah.
In those kind of safari parks, you're supposed to drive slowly or stop for a moment and then keep going.
But like she,
I don't know.
Yeah, no, she stopped driving because they were like being attacked and she was like screaming and everything. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so then she races the car away. And that night, Robert presses her to admit her misgivings and fears about Damien. And she asks to see a psychiatrist.
She's like, I just feel like he's not mine.
Right? And he's like, oh, poppycock.
He's like, you're crazy. Go see a psychiatrist.
But she actually asks.
I'm joking.
Yeah.
I'm joking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That would be pretty fucked up if he's rude. Like gaslighting her. Like, I know. That.
He'd be like, you just sound nuts. Go to the mental ward.
So now Robert is watching a rugby game. Jennings is there with his camera. Robert is again accosted by Father Brennan, who insists on meeting with him, saying, your wife is in danger. She'll die unless you come. And at this point, Jennings snaps another picture of Brennan as he walks away. Developing this one in the dark room, Jennings sees again the black line slashing into Brennan in the photo. Mm-hmm. So then soon Robert meets Brennan as requested, you know, in this park by the river. And Brennan starts pontificating. When the Jews return to Zion and a comet rips the sky, the Holy Roman Emperor rises, then you and I must die. From the eternal sea, he rises, creating armies on either shore, turning man against his brother till man exists no more. And Robert's like, cool poem. Mm-hmm. So then Brennan explains that the devil's final attack on man was predicted by the Book of Revelations to be the full possession of a human. And he tells Robert to go to an ancient city and find a man called Bugenhagen, which this, going back to the first time I showed Grace this movie, mm-hmm. she was pretty young because this was one of the early ones where I'm like, this isn't actually going to scare you, but it's a classic. Mm-hmm. I think she was maybe like 10 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember at some point after this Bugenhagen character was introduced, her making like a Star Wars joke and going, Thorn, I am your Bugenhagen. And I was like, aw, look at you.
You little scamp.
So proud of you. But anyway, Brennan says that Bugenhagen is the only man that can describe how the child must die. And Robert asks about what Brennan said about Kathy being in danger. And Brennan tells him that Kathy is pregnant. Robert says that that's impossible. But Brennan insists he, meaning, you know, we guess Damien, but he hasn't really been clear about that. He will not allow the child to be born. He'll kill it while it slumbers in the womb. And then finally, Brennan says plainly that Damien is the son of the devil, that he'll kill the unborn child, then the mother. And then when he's sure to inherit all that's yours, he'll kill you, too.
Yeah.
So here,
and you're like, quick, make up a will.
Post haste. So then that Robert orders Brennan to stay away from him. And then he walks away. But just before he walks away, like a freak storm starts blowing up. It gets stronger and stronger. Brennan now, because now Robert's gone. Brennan is trying to leave and struggling to walk through this storm as it worsens. And then lightning strikes a tree nearby. And, you know, a branch falls and Brennan aims to take shelter in a nearby church. So he runs over to it. But before he can get inside, a spike atop the church is also struck by lightning and falls, plunging through Brennan's body and pinning him standing upright to the ground. And just like that, the weather's fine. The storm like stops immediately right mm-hmm. after he's killed. So RIP Father Brennan.
And that storm went on for a long time. Felt like I was like, this is like 20 minutes. What's going on? I was probably like two, but it felt like a long time. It's like he's just like trudging through the yard. He's like, oh, it's so windy.
Oh, the wind. I have to lean into it. And lucky for him, there was a church right there, mm-hmm. right nearby.
Or not so lucky.
Not so lucky. If only churches weren't covered by so many dangerous spires.
Spikes and gargoyles.
Absolutely. They're highly, highly risky.
And spears.
Just waiting to be struck by lightning. Spears. Okay, at home, Kathy is irritable, and Robert says maybe he should talk to her psychiatrist. She agrees and says out of the blue, I don't ever want to have any more children. I'm like, okay, that's a very Gone with the Wind type thing to say. Mm-hmm. And so Robert concedes and is like, okay, of course, if you don't want to, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And so then she says, then you'll agree to an abortion. And he's like, wait, the what now? Mm-hmm. Like when he agreed to her not having any more children, he didn't know that she was, I mean, Brennan had told him, but he didn't believe it. And he didn't yet know that she was already pregnant.
Yeah.
Just then, a phone call comes in telling Robert to check the newspaper where he finds the article reporting Brennan's bizarre death. So he's like, you know what? This is a lot of weird shit. A lot of weird shit's happening.
Yeah, he was like, no, that's ridiculous. Oh, wait, what? Oh,
she is pregnant, and now he's dead. So next, Robert meets with the psychiatrist, who explains Kathy's struggles with the idea of having another baby and her, quote, delusions about Damien, that he's alien or evil, or that he's not hers. And Robert's sitting there, like, pulling at his collar, being like, yeah, delusions.
He's like, about that.
Yeah. Can I be honest with you, Doc?
Gotta fess up.
Yeah. Time to come clean.
It's been 5 years. I gotta just say something really.
The doctor argues with Robert that having another baby would be disastrous for Kathy's mental health, but Robert refuses the abortion. Mm-hmm. And that kind of makes sense at this point, because he does know that Damien's not their child, mm-hmm. and the baby that she's carrying is their child.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously it's problematic that, you know, it's nice that this was an era and a country where abortion was a legal option. But I'm sure you probably, if you were married, had to have your husband's consent in order to obtain one. Because, you know, women still didn't have, you know, full autonomy and rights for things like that. But anyway, like you can, from an emotional standpoint, legal and political issues aside, you can see why Robert wouldn't want end the pregnancy.
Yeah.
Because that actually is their child.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sad. Like, he doesn't come across as a dick being like, absolutely not, she can't have an abortion. You're like, oh, okay. No, I get it.
Right. But at the same time, I'm like, why does he get to choose this?
Yeah, he shouldn't.
I just get too mad. I'm mad. I get mad about it.
Yeah. So as Robert races home in the car, Damien races around the nursery on his tricycle. So they're like kind of cutting back and forth, juxtaposing those two scenes. And then Mrs. Baylock looks on as Damien ramps up speed, going round and round and round the nursery on his tricycle. While in the hall, Kathy is trying to water a hanging plant and she can't quite reach. So she pulls an end table over and climbs up onto it. And then in that moment, Mrs. Baylock opens the nursery door, sending Damien forth, and he furiously pedals the tricycle into the table Kathy stands on. She falls over the railing and her fingers slowly slip. She gradually loses her grip before slamming into the floor below. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, you know, dramatic moment, and Damien's just watching her. Like, yeah. She's like, help me, Damien, help me. Not that he could have, I mean, he's a 5-year-old. He couldn't have, like, pulled her up or anything, but he's just watching her as her, you know, she slowly loses her grip and then she falls.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh my God, he's trying to kill his mother.
Well, Mrs. Blaylock's also like 2 feet away, and she's like, oh, bummer for you.
She's like, oh, look at that. I guess we shouldn't have been watering the plants, should mm-hmm. we, Mrs.? So Robert arrives at the hospital and is told by the doctor that Kathy's lost the baby. Kathy manages to get the words out to tell Robert, don't let him kill me. So her, you know, we already knew that she was had these, quote, delusions about Damien being evil. And so now this experience that she's had and like watching him watch her, like she's now fully convinced that like this kid is going to kill her, is trying to kill her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robert returns home that night, and in Damien's room, he sees that the dog is still there, so he's a little pissed about that. The ringing phone draws him away, and the call is from Jennings, our photographer, asking for a meeting. When Robert goes to Jennings' flat, Jennings shows him not only the black lines on the photos of Brennan that foretold the way that the spike killed him, but also lines that appeared on the pictures Jennings took of the nanny that foretold the rope of her noose. So mm-hmm. the pictures that he had taken of her at the party before she killed herself mimicked where the noose eventually was when she did. Jennings also shares that he talked to the coroner and found out that Brennan had a birthmark in the shape of 3 6s, which is, you know, the kind of privileged information that coroners just share with random photographers that call him up. Be like, tell me, is there anything strange about the body? And you're like, yes, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked.
Well, was he a reporter or no? I was confused.
Well, he was a photographer. So yeah, maybe he wasn't a reporter. Maybe he was just like a freelance. I imagine that that's how he would make his money mm-hmm. because he was also photographing like public things. You know, it's not like he was a wedding photographer or like a family photographer. So I imagine that he sold his photos.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyhow, didn't seem like the coroner should have just disclosed details about a dead body that he had no connection to.
That's fine.
That's fine. And also, you can't get an abortion.
I know. Like, will you just tell everyone about the body?
Yeah.
And maybe in those days, I'm just joking. But, you know, remember in olden times, they'd set bodies out for people just to look at.
That's true.
You
know, so. That's true. Well, we do crazy, like crazy. Bodies lie in state nowadays, like presidents and royalty and everything, yeah. Like for, you know, public to queue up and view and pay respects to. But in this case, it was that he had a birthmark in the shape of 3 sixes. So next, Jennings takes Robert to visit Brennan's room, the room that he was staying in. And maybe this is another reason why I kind of had him as a reporter in my head is because he's kind of, I mean, he's investigating, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we find out that he has a reason to be investigating, and maybe this isn't something he's ever done before or does regularly. But anyhow, he takes Robert to Brennan's room where he's already been. All the walls and windows are papered with pages from the Bible, and there are 47 crucifixes hung all around this small room. Jennings had found in Brennan's paper an article about a comet that appeared over Europe 5 years earlier on June 6th. And there's also a clipping of the birth announcement. 6 month, 6 day. And Jennings asks Robert, was your son born at 6 a.m.? And this whole time, Robert is just like, this is one of those moments where you like, you have an actor like Gregory Peck, and this is where it matters, mm-hmm. because he's not saying anything. Jennings is just loading him up with all of this information that he's found in all of his questioning and researching and you know, the work that he's done and just kind of unloading it all. And Gregory Peck is not speaking. Mm-hmm. And then just that moment where Jennings asks him, was your son born at 6 a.m.? And like, Gregory Peck's like expression, like it's so perfect. And then he delivers the line, my son is dead. I don't know whose son I'm raising. Mm-hmm. And that like that moment and that line performed by a lesser actor wouldn't have carried as much weight, wouldn't have been as impactful, because it really is like a meaningful moment. Like it kind of shows like him accepting that this is all real, like, yeah. Because he's been, you know, fighting against it, even like the coincidences or, you know, the strange happenings or whatever. Like, he's a man of reason and didn't want to actually believe any of this bullshit. Yeah. But that moment was pretty significant.
I felt like the wall kind of finally came down a little bit.
Yeah.
Crumbled.
Yeah. And he's like, okay, now the shit has hit the fan.
Yeah.
So then Jennings asks Robert if he can help him find out. Who in the answer to that question of whose son I'm raising. But when Robert refuses, Jennings shows Robert a photo that Jennings accidentally took of himself, showing a black slash across his own neck. Mm-hmm. And so then he was like, I need to help you find it, because he recognizes that that means that he's now marked for death like the previous two people, mm-hmm. that had that happen in their photos. And so he has a vested interest in figuring out the solution to this problem.
He's like, I don't want that to happen to me. That sounds...
Look at this great picture I took.
Sounds like a bummer.
Yeah. So before leaving Kathy safe at the hospital, and I put safe in quotation marks, Robert learns that the rest of the household staff at his giant manor has up and quit. But Mrs. Baylock's on the job. She's like, don't you mind, sir. I can handle it.
I'm here peeling potatoes.
So many potatoes.
I don't need you or anyone else.
I'm feeding just the child and a Rottweiler, and I need 100 potatoes. So Robert and Jennings are off to Rome to, you know, pursue their investigation. But when the cab driver takes them where they want to go, they find out that the hospital where Damien was born burned down, .. 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Robert asks a nurse that is in the building now about the priest he knew, Spoleto. And she says that he survived the fire and is now in a monastery. On the drive there, Jennings finds Brennan's verses in Revelations. So the when the Jews return to Zion, blah, 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 blah. And the two men, as they drive, analyze the modern events that correlate with the biblical indicators of the birth of the Antichrist. So like, oh, here was the comet, and here was the, you know, the European, it wasn't European Union, the Treaty of Rome, and like all this stuff, mm-hmm. Is the like modern version of the rise of the Roman Empire, including the interpretation of the quote eternal sea. So from the eternal sea, he rises, being the world of politics, which we know is Robert's world.
Yeah, yeah.
Being an in not he, yeah, he is an ambassador. Mm-hmm. I was a foreign relations, I would say, would be his profession. So at the monastery, they find Spoleto, who no longer speaks, but who has shared in writing that he must do penance for abandoning Christ. Robert demands to know where Damien's mother is now, and Spoleto writes a name, Chervet, which another priest explains is an old cemetery in ruins that is 50 kilometers north of Rome. Arriving at the cemetery late at night, Robert and Jennings break in and find graves with Damien's birth date for a mother and a baby. In the mother's grave, they find the skeleton of a jackal. And then against Jennings' urges, Robert insists on opening the baby's grave and finds...
Jennings like, let's get the fuck out of here.
Basically. He's like, you know what? And it's a legitimate point, like what good could come of it? You mm-hmm. know, because like in theory, it's empty. And if it's not empty, you don't want to know what's in there.
Yeah.
But Robert opens the baby's grave and finds the remains of his own son with a hole in his skull. So, you know, they killed him, you know, and it's another mm-hmm. very dramatic moment that could have been overacted by a lesser performer.
Yeah. But just a little switcheroo.
Yeah. Suddenly the men are surrounded by snarling dogs and must race out of the cemetery, just barely escaping. Which is, mm-hmm. that's a pretty intense scene. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I don't need to describe it in detail, but it's lengthy. The music that they accompany with and the camera angles. It's, you know, not a lot of moments in this movie you would consider scary nowadays. And I yeah. wouldn't say that this one is either, but it is exciting.
They're fighting off all these hellhounds.
Okay, so Robert calls Kathy in the hospital with arrangements to get her out of London because he's like, this shit's real. She's in danger. They've already tried to kill her. They've already killed the baby. And then Kathy's like, oh, okay, I'll get ready. And so she's struggling to change her clothes with all of the fucking casts she's got on all over her body.
And then her nightgown was all
stuck over her head.
But it's like see-through.
Gossamer.
Stuff.
All gauzy. Yeah. Sexy hospital nightgown.
I know. I'm like, why are you wearing that? Okay.
But unfortunately, in that moment, Mrs. Baylock appears. And the next thing we know, Kathy's falling again. This time from a fourth story window through the roof of an ambulance. Mm-hmm. So super dead. Robert gets a call with the news immediately. And he's devastated.
Yeah.
Obviously. No. He's lost his beloved wife. And now, with nothing left to lose, he pledges to kill Damien, and he and Jennings head to an excavation outside of Jerusalem to meet Mr. Bugenhagen.
Yeah, tell him how to do it.
Yep, we need instructions on baby killing. There, Bugenhagen gives Robert a set of knives and instructions on how to kill Damien. He has to do it in a church, so the blood spills on the altar of God. Robert asks if there's proof to know that Damien is truly the Antichrist, and Bugenhagen says he'll bear the birthmark of the three sixes. Robert says that he knows Damien has no birthmark. He's like, I've bathed him. He's like, he's raised this child from birth. Like, he has no birthmark. But Bugenhagen says it must be beneath the hair. And then we think back like, oh yeah, the baby was born with hair.
With black hair.
Yeah. Bugenhagen also says Mrs. Baylock is an apostate of hell and will die to protect Damien. So he's like, yeah, okay, great hire there. Robert leaves Bugenhagen, and outside he argues with Jennings because Robert is doubting the whole thing. Like, how can he murder a child? It's insane. Like, his reason is still trying to push in on all of this and be like, come on now, this can't be true, this can't be real.
I think it's like after the death of his wife, he's like, I have to kill him. And then he's like, wait, no, really though?
Yeah, am I actually gonna murder a child? And so Robert hurls the knives away down this alley. Jenning runs after them saying, fine, you know, I'll do it, because he still knows his life is on the line. Mm-hmm. And as he stoops to gather the knives, a runaway truck rolls toward him, releasing a sheet of glass that decapitates him. And it's kind of like a Rube Goldberg thing where, like, oh, this pin popped and then this thing fell out from behind the wheel and then this truck rolled here and then it bumped over that rock, which made the thing, and then the sheet of glass.
It was definitely a Final Destination moment.
100%. And I also love that they showed the decapitation no fewer than 6 times from various angles.
I know, they're like, in case you didn't see it, it's this way.
Yeah, look at the head off.
Everyone's like, oh God.
And then it cuts immediately to the next shot of Robert on a plane home with the knives on his lap. He is convinced.
He's like, well, guess I gotta.
That was
guess
cool.
I'm gonna go on home with these knives.
Okay, I'm almost done. This was a long one. So arriving home, Robert creeps into the house like he's sneaking into the dark house. It is nighttime again. And at this point, there's whispered chants, like the Latin chants, but instead of being like, duh, 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 like super loud and like jarring, they're whispered. And I actually found this to be way creepier. Like him walking like silently through this dark house.
Well, you know, it's been cleared out of people except for Mrs. What's her name?
Miss Baylock. And
and then there's Damien, and then there's the dog, which... Mm-hmm.
That damn dog.
Who's a menace.
That damn dog. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just I think like the whispering, like I remember, because I've seen this movie many times over the years. And when I was rewatching it to do this recap and getting to that scene, I was like, ooh, 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 that's creepy. Mm-hmm. And then Robert, you know, the dog is there, like you say, and he's there to help protect Damien. But Robert managed to cleverly capture him in the cellar, like luring him and tricking him and then locking him in the cellar. Robert goes to Kathy's room. His grief is apparent as he goes into her sewing kit to take her sewing scissors.
Yeah.
He goes next into Damien's room, gently finds under the hair that he cuts away the birthmark of 666. And I was like, you know who else was... Okay, sorry. Forgot this was another one of Tom's jokes that I put in my notes, and I forgot to note that that's what it was. And I was like, wait, what the fuck did I write here? Because this is the point where Tom turned to me and goes, you know who else was born with a full head of hair? You. And I was like, God damn it. I was. But then so was Grace. So a full head of dark hair. Yep. That's
devil
why.
Devil children.
Devil children. And I'm reproducing. I made another
it's
devil
all
child.
Bad. Yep. All bad.
All bad things.
Cheryl and Deke both had dark hair.
Yeah. Were they born bald or were they born with hair?
Dark hair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Full heads of hair.
I think we all need to have a head shaving party to make sure nobody has any 666 birthmarks.
You can't be too sure.
Yeah.
Well, no one's coming to my house to peel potatoes. So
absolutely. If I show up with 100 potatoes.
Potatoes. Like, well,
and a Rottweiler.
I'll allow it. It's fine. It's okay.
Okay, so now he's found the birthmark on Damien's head. And as the proof sinks in, suddenly Mrs. Baylock in her PJs attacks him from behind, just like leaps through the air like a spider monkey right on his shoulders and is just like, ah! I'm like clawing and scrapping
she's like,
at him.
I'm gonna get ya.
Gonna get ya. Robert obviously overpowers her because she's this little woman. Mm-hmm. And he grabs Damien and runs. But before he can get out of the house, Baylock is back and there's struggle again. But this time he really gets her right in the neck with a meat fork.
Yeah.
It's a glorious moment.
He's like, and stay put.
This time.
I'm tired of you.
Yeah, I'm tired of your crap.
You got a dog. You let go of the staff.
Yeah, so this is all obviously building up to the climax
the big
of the film.
Climax.
Yeah, like him entering the silent house, the whispering and everything is like, you know, your baseline, and then it rises and it rises, the revelation of the birthmark, the attack of Mrs. Baylock, killing Mrs. Baylock, and now Robert has gotten Damien into the car and he races off. This immediately raises an alarm with a Bobby who calls it in and gives chase. Because they know that it's the ambassador's car. It's like a consulate car and he's leaving the building. Like, I think the police officer is even one of the ones that like guards, you know, it's like the guard shack or whatever, the property.
Yeah.
But he just like peels out of there like at top speed, obviously driving illegally fast, but also just raising concern in general.
Yeah.
And so the cop calls it in and starts driving after him. Robert makes it all the way to a church and carries the screaming Damien up to the altar. But at the last moment, with Robert holding the dagger high in the air, Damien is crying, please, daddy, no. And this is the only other time he talks is during this. Like, he's just screaming for most of it. But then he does say, please, daddy, no. And Robert hesitates for just a moment, just long enough for the cops that have arrived to shoot him.
Yeah, and they're like, drop it, drop it. And he's like,
I'm gonna get you. So now we cut to the military funeral for the ambassador and his wife. So both, because, you know, obviously they died like within 24 hours of each other. So they get a couple's funeral. Mm-hmm. And after the flag is folded, Robert's old pal, the U.S. president, stays behind for a moment as between him and his wife stand their charge, Robert's son, Damien, Damien is holding their hands, and then we're looking at their backs. He turns to the camera, gazes for a moment, and then smiles. Mm-hmm. And then a final verse appears on the screen. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Revelation 13:18. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's just basically the completion of Damien's plan, exactly as Brennan told, like, he'll kill the baby, he'll kill the mother, and then once he's sure to inherit all that's yours, he'll kill you too.
Yeah.
So that is The Omen.
Yeah.
Hey, Meredith, did you think it was scary?
No.
No.
Well, I really enjoyed it when I was younger, because I watched this movie when I was, like, in middle school.
Yeah, probably. Same.
And I remember being like, oh, this is really fun and crazy and
dark and intriguing. You
know, yeah. And I knew where Gregory Peck was. I knew him from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
So I really enjoyed the movie. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, serious. Mm-hmm. And just really well done. And then in the end, when he ends up in like the home of the most powerful person on Earth, basically.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it just all came to fruition. Mm-hmm. Everything.
The plan.
You know,
nothing even, anybody did stopped it.
Yeah. Even in spite of all the, you know, trying to intervene and stop it from happening. The wheels were already in motion. It was going to happen. So did I think it was scary? No. But did I find it really powerful, really great performances? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really, really good. So, I mean, I'd recommend it to anybody
who
would want to watch a kind of dated. So,
yeah.
But, fun movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's dated in a different way, because if you go look at, like, you know, like the shitty 80s, like, horror movies that were being made, like, that's dated in a different way. Like, oh my God, terrible makeup and bad acting and like, you know, low budget and a bad script or whatever. And this is dated. It just, it feels like a classic film. Like if you were going to go watch a Bogart film or something.
Yes. Yeah.
So it just feels like you're watching an old movie.
Yeah.
Rather than like, oh, this sucks.
This is very bad. You know? This is so bad. Although the priest's makeup in the monastery was not great.
No, to make him look like a burn victim.
It looked like,
yeah, that was pretty
decoupage on his face.
Decoupage with a bit of macrame.
Yeah, a little macrame, some glitter. Did you think it was scary?
No, I think that, you know, when I first saw it when I was younger, I think that it did scare me a little bit. I think now we're so desensitized to this Catholic Church, demonic, devil, Satan stuff, because it is so played out and overused. But this was, I mean, this was before, just a couple years before The Exorcist, correct? Wasn't that 78?
I know it's, well, the 76, Rosemary's Baby was 68.
Right. Yeah, I think this The Exorcist was shortly after this. But this, the idea.
It was 73.
Oh, Exorcist was first.
Yeah.
Okay.
And The Exorcist 2 came out in 77.
Okay.
So they're all kind of around the same.
Yeah, grouped together. And like, but I think just this idea of using Catholic doctrine as the basis for a horror movie storyline is, I'm not going to call it lazy now, but it the reason why, so I think, and I've said this before, so many horror movies use that as their topic is because you've got the built-in material already there. You can manipulate it however you want. There's already a sense of supernatural or mysticism associated with it that you don't have to bring to the table. You don't have to produce. Mm-hmm. It's just right there. And there's some fucked up stuff in the Bible, like Book of Revelations. Like there are some things that actually are in the Bible that if you read them, you're like, what the fuck? what did Jesus say?
Yeah.
And so it's an easy like avenue to go down to make something to try and scare people. But this, The Omen, even, you know, coming out after The Exorcist, like it was still kind of a novel idea, I think, to use this, like the Catholic Church, the priesthood, biblical history interpretation, things like that to try and tell a scary story.
Yeah, I think I was going to say that in The Exorcist, they turned to the Catholic Church for help. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, the Catholic Church part of it was like a sect aside from it, or people kind of like who weaseled their way into the Catholic mm-hmm. Church who were part of this yeah. plan that was ancient
yeah,
and foretold for how many generations? And they're mm-hmm. like setting the balls into motion or whatever. So yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting. It's like, who can you trust?
Yeah.
You know, these priests and these nuns, and they're like, oh, well, here's this baby for yeah. you.
We just murdered your baby. Here's yeah. another one.
And you're like, oh my God. Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to do this movie now is because that movie, The First Omen, just came out. Tom and I did go see it. And I'm not going to like spoil it or anything. I'm still on the fence about how I felt about it. I definitely think that it's worth seeing, especially if you're familiar with the canon of the other movies. It had some scary scenes. It was very gory, but not in like slasher film murder gory, in like ways that were a little bit more upsetting. It is a prequel to this this film, and it does tie in perfectly, which for me, that's like a trigger for me, a little picadillo of mine, that like if you make a prequel and then it contradicts something that happens in the original movie, that pisses me right off. Like, I have a really hard time enjoying a movie if I'll be like, okay, but that guy was dead. Like, you can't.
What's the point?
Yeah. That's not what happened. Like, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have done that because in the original, this happened, you know?
Yeah.
But this one really, it foretold some of the stuff in this original movie. The Catholic Church, we call that prefiguring. And it also aligned perfectly with the events that happened. Like, it actually, the First Omen ends exactly where this movie begins, with that night in Rome.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But exactly like yeah, yeah, Nell Tigerfree.
Mm-hmm. She was in The Servant.
Right? Yeah, and yeah, she was also I was like, her face, I was like, oh, what is it? Was it she was just in a couple of episodes. She was in Game of Thrones. She was Marcella in the part of the season where Marcella was in with the Sands.
Okay.
Anyway, and she was younger then and blonde. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that stood out to me in First Omen is exactly what you just said, like about the original, that by and large in these movies that use the Catholic Church as their vehicle for a scary story, you go to the church for help. Mm-hmm. Like the doctors don't have the answer, so we go to a priest.
Yeah.
And then the priest is there and he drives out the demon or sacrifices himself or whatever, and they save them. Mm-hmm. But in the, just exactly like you said, like in this one, in the original, it doesn't seem like it goes all the way to the top. But yeah. There are definitely like evil people that have infiltrated the priesthood and the church in order to carry out these plans. Mm-hmm. And in the First Omen, that that idea, that concept is even more prevalent. Mm-hmm. What it reminded me a little bit of is, did you ever see Exorcist Believer, like that new one?
Mm-mm.
With the two girls?
No, I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, okay. Then I won't say the connection, but when you do watch it, I think you might also see a connection between this idea of like the church isn't the answer.
Yeah.
Like they're not infallible, they're not perfect, and mm-hmm. And sometimes they're the source of the problem.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so I think that that's an interesting, you know, perspective, because almost all of the other movies that use that, it's like the priest is the hero that rolls in and saves yeah. everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
Father Marin.
So what do you, I mean, yeah. I mean,
Father Karras.
What do you do when your go-to for comfort or some kind of help or whatever has been, you know, compromised?
Yes, exactly.
So badly.
And yeah, it turns out to be
against you.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like in Rosemary's Baby, her husband.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the person you're supposed to be depending on, mm-hmm. and to find out, you know, we already did this episode on that. So sorry if I spoiled, but yeah. You know, it's like, that's who you're having a baby with. That's the person who's always has been the voice of reason. Like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, whatever. He's very like, guy was cynical, mm-hmm. and he was somebody who'd be like, yeah, that's ridiculous. And then to be like, oh, you're in on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Or for example, this, like, you know, what do you do when it, you know, your church has betrayed you, mm-hmm. basically. 'Cause they seem not religious really, but like, that's something that probably you would assume that you wouldn't be tricked,
yeah.
you know, by the church.
Yeah, there's an expectation of trust.
Yeah.
And, you know, without going into all of the ways that the Catholic Church has betrayed the public's trust.
It's been numerous. But
yeah, it's not great.
No, but this is before even that, you know, decades before that came to light.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying it wasn't happening. Right. I'm saying before the public was
universally
known,
being responded to.
But I think that also that's also why I like this movie so much is that, but also that kind of common theme where what do you do when it's somebody kind of in your net of people mm-hmm. that you are supposed to be yourself entirely and trust entirely? What do you do when that's compromised, like mm-hmm. your mother, your partner, your church, versus an outsider coming mm-hmm. in and attacking you, like in Halloween? He came from prison to come to kill, or the mental hospital to come to kill you, or you know, the common trope with an outsider coming in, the stranger's home invasion, and what happens when it's from within.
Yeah. When you're most vulnerable.
Yeah. So that's why, I mean, that's scary.
Yeah. Bringing it into your home and having it be, something that, you know, not only do you trust, but you like rely on, mm-hmm. like a nanny.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the access that, I mean, like priests, the access that they have to the innermost parts of people's lives.
Yeah.
And then to find out that person is not to be trusted.
Yeah.
And is, you know, potentially trying to harm you mm-hmm.
and
or
that's
bring
why
the Antichrist into the world.
Yep. That's not cool. Come on. I mean, that's why I loved Hereditary, for example, so much, you know, because that was came out of nowhere, kind mm-hmm. of. And it was so well done. But
I also should mention since I mentioned the prequel that just came out, there were three original sequels to this first Omen that Gregory Peck made. The second one was called Damien the Omen 2, and it was released in 1978. So not long after.
Yeah.
And it featured William Holden, who's someone that I love, and mm-hmm. also Lance Henriksen, mm-hmm. who is someone else that I love. And in that film, Damien is about to turn 13 years old. So he's a tween. And it's just the point in his life. It tells the story of the point in his life when he learns that he's the Antichrist for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like, there are still people in and around him in a network that are protecting him and guiding him. And the movers and shakers that are setting everything up so that as he becomes an adult, he'll be poised to, you know, take on, you know, world domination, I guess. But at that point, like up until that point, like he's kind of aware sometimes that there's like some strange things, but he doesn't know anything yet.
He's kind of like a little bit of a Harry Potter where he wants something to happen to somebody and he's like, mm-hmm. oh, well, that happened.
Oh, I guess that was lucky.
My bully ended up under the ice. Bummer for you. And you're like, well, a little more of a quit. There's kind of reasons, but
yeah. And this is one where, you know, you wonder with sequels, like the scripts, in what order they were written, if they were written together, if they were written by the same people or different people, because the implication that I always had at the end of the original Omen was that the president adopted Damien, like mm-hmm. the president was going to raise him. Mm-hmm. But in this film, we find that he, he's being raised by his uncle, and that's who William Holden is.
Yeah.
He was Robert's brother. I can't remember what his name was, what the brother's name was. But that's who, and so Damien is being raised by his uncle, his father's brother, with a cousin who's like is the same age as him. Mm-hmm. And so he's just having this great boyhood off in military school. And like, obviously they're very wealthy and affluent and everything, but it's not like he's being raised in the White House.
Yeah.
So that was something where I don't know if that's a continuity break or if my assumption at the end of the first one was that the president was adopting him was false. And it was just that, you know, they were taking care of him for the time being until, or like they were the ones that were going to travel with him from London back to his parents or whatever.
Yeah.
So then the, second sequel, the third movie, came out in 1981, and they called it The Final Conflict, as, you know, horror movie sequels like to do, like how Friday the 13th, what is it, chapter 4 is the final chapter, and then there are 11 total.
But psych. Psych. We're doing how many more?
Yeah. So 1981, this one starred Sam Neill as Damien. So obviously he's an adult.
I love Sam Neill.
Love Sam Neill. And he's younger than, you know, I fell in love with him in Jurassic Park. And oh, obviously he's significantly younger in this film, but he is an adult. And he obviously has known now for many years that he is the Antichrist, and he has been participating with and working toward his, you know, plans of domination throughout it. And then, of course, there's always the forces that are trying to stop him or take him down. And so that's the content of The Final Conflict. The next one didn't come out for 10 years. It came out in 1991 and it was called Omen 4, The Awakening. And in this one, it's just basically like, oh, we have a new Antichrist. Mm-hmm. This family adopts a little girl. She's named Delia. But she
after
is
after the catalog.
Everything she's wearing has daisies on it and is so low rise. You wouldn't believe.
So chunky.
So chunky. The flip flops are so chunky. But anyway, so that's just a, hey, let's reboot this. And instead it's of a boy, make it a girl and fun stuff. So that was the fourth one. And it, like, you know, the sequels, they're not terrible. They're not great.
Yeah.
You know, if you are a horror movie fan and you've seen the original, I would say watch them once just to get the, you know, the picture.
They were fine. I mean, I think I watched them in college or something. I was like, oh, you know, what are we going to watch? Oh, let's watch all the Omens.
Yeah.
The fourth one was completely forgettable. I don't even know if I even watched it, but I for sure watched the second one and the Sam Neill one.
Yeah.
And I remember he like whipped his hair around all the time.
He's like, oh, yeah. He definitely, it was like the emo kids on South Park that are always like flipping the hair out of their face.
And this is he did A Cry in the Dark in 88 with Sam Neill. So
oh, yeah.
He was very young. And I thought he was young in that movie, but he's even younger in The Omen, the third one.
And then the last one to mention is the remake that came out in 2006. Liev Schreiber played Robert, and Julia Stiles played Kathy. I liked it.
Not to mention
Remus.
Wait,
what?
Who played the nanny?
Oh, it was
Mia Farrow. Mia Farrow
was the nanny. I was like, Rosemary. No, the actress's name.
Mia.
Yes, Mia Farrow played Mrs. Baylock.
And I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. I love seeing her.
And then Jennings, the photographer, was played by that English actor who was in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Lupin. Professor Lupin.
Professor Lupin.
The werewolf. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I thought, like I mentioned earlier, it really follows the original very closely. Not shot for shot, but, you know, pretty much scene for scene. They add a couple of elements that weren't in the original that allowed them to do some, like, you know, kind of scarier visual stuff, because obviously they had more at their disposal, like technology wise and makeup wise and special effects and stuff when they made this. But also, I feel just like we were talking about how the original, it wasn't trying to be a horror movie the way that we conceptualize horror now. The remake, what I think, was trying to be more of a horror movie.
Yeah,
to tell the same story, but like insert elements that would make it land more like a horror movie now.
Right. I mean, even their casting choice for Damien was too obvious.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to the first one or the original where you're like, oh, he's just a cute little brunette little kid.
Yeah. And this one's like, no, he's pale with black hair and ice
blue
eyes. And dark
circles under his eyes. Yeah. And he looks like he's been living, like he has a little doll he pokes needles into or something.
Yeah. And he also, like, the barely speaks, like the character in the remake, mm-hmm. like in the original, barely speaks throughout the movie. But it ends exactly the same way as the original, with Damien in the charge of the president. I liked the remake a lot. I think it's definitely worth watching also.
Yeah, I liked it too. I saw it once, but I liked the casting mm-hmm. for the first one, or excuse me, the remake for, mm-hmm. of the first one. But I haven't seen the prequel. I'll watch it eventually when it comes to streaming, probably.
Yeah, you can do a double feature, do Exorcist Beginning and then do First Omen.
Yeah.
In one night, and then watch a lot of Schitt's Creek.
I know. I'm like,
I feel so bad.
I have a few fun facts.
Yay.
That's what I bring to the table when I don't do the summary.
That's not what I do when I don't do the summary. I just show up with nothing.
You're like, what's up? Give me some wine. I'm like, okay. Okay, so it came out more like 40 something years ago now, because like it said released 48 years ago on this week on an article, but it was like several years ago, so mm-hmm. it's been a while.
Yeah, almost 50.
Yeah. I want to say 48 years. Anyway, so I thought it was interesting that the role of Ambassador Thorne was first offered to Charlton Heston.
Oh my god.
but he was like, I don't need to do that.
I'm making movies about apes. I'm gonna stick with my apes.
I did Moses. No, he thought it would be cheesy, and he passed. He passed on it. And then, of course, William Holden passed as well, and really
regretted
it. So then he did, the sequel. But then Gregory Peck, who his career was in a huge slump at that point, mm-hmm. like really slump. He was considering retiring because it was just like kind of
wasn't getting offers.
Yeah. So then he took the role for a fraction of his usual fee, $250,000.
Oh, wow.
And then also he was like, I'll take that. And then 10% of the film's gross.
Nice.
Which ended up becoming the biggest payday he'd ever had in his whole career, because it made like millions of 60 something million dollars.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun. So then also the 4-year-old Harvey Stevens, who was Damien, he attacked the director and went wild during the casting. And they're like, I love this. This is great.
This is exactly what we want. Stitch up that director. And you're fired.
He like kicked him in the face. He like kicked him in the dick or something. He's just like went crazy. And he had like blonde hair. And they're like, dye this child's hair black. And he has the part, basically. Yeah. So I thought that was fun. But then also there's like, I think it's kind of silly when I hear about a bunch of coincidences happening around a movie.
We did it with Poltergeist.
Yeah, but apparently planes were struck by lightning. There was head-on collisions, mm-hmm. like all this stuff, accidents.
But wasn't there a bunch with the Exorcist premiere too? Like it was like a church across the street, and some weird shit happened on opening night.
I guess so, but I'm like, yeah, I guess I believe that this happened, but I don't think it has to do with the subject matter of the movie.
You sound just like Robert Thorne.
I know. Let's see. What else? I thought that it was fun that the composer, he'd written 300 movie and TV scores in his 50-year career. He was nominated for the Academy Award for The Omen, and mm-hmm. he didn't bother showing up because he's like, I'm not going to win. But then he did win.
Oh, my God.
So that's kind of fun. The Omen made so much money, it was the fifth biggest hit of that year. Mm-hmm. They were able to make so much money that they were able to give George Lucas money he needed to finish Star Wars.
Excellent.
So, thank goodness mm-hmm. The Omen happened. Otherwise,
what guided Grace to make the Bugenhagen joke.
Probably.
She knew that. She already knew all these fun facts.
Yeah. So George Lucas had the money he needed to make Star Wars the way he wanted. So Fox was able to do that. Mm-hmm. And then the other part I thought was kind of sad, though, but Gregory Peck approached the role very seriously. He's like, this is a family in crisis. You know, he's very mm-hmm. serious. But shortly before he started this movie, his son had taken his own life.
Oh, my God.
So he was dealing with a lot of his own grief and stuff like that when he was filming. So I was like, that's really sad. And you can kind of see there's some grief in that, in this role. But he did such an amazing job, and he's Gregory Peck. So
Gregory freaking Peck.
He's always going to be Atticus. He's always going to be the father everyone wants.
Yeah.
We love him.
But I love them in Roman holiday.
Yeah. So those are just some of the fun and not so fun facts.
Fun and maybe just interesting.
Interesting facts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that's like heartbreaking.
Yeah.
To think about, you know, having your son take their life and then make a movie where your son is murdered and then you have to kill your replacement son. Like that's too
isn't that strange?
Close to home.
Yeah, and then knowing that and that his career was in the toilet.
Yeah.
And then he's like, "Well, this is my one shot."
Yeah.
And I have to take this movie role or maybe let me see where you know, but I enjoyed the movie though when it's become like a huge staple and
absolutely
reference, you know, for decades.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where it's it gave us concepts or images that are just part of our social fabric now that people don't even necessarily like just the creepy child.
Oh, in the or the cemetery with the little boy and the page boy in the little hat.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that?
Yeah.
It's the omen. The son of the devil.
Yeah. So it's very intrinsic. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, aside from, you know, this remake and the prequel, like, you know, there's just, I keep saying that there's so many movies that utilize this same Catholic Church biblical material. And I think that this is, for me, kind of like the foundational one.
Definitely. Yeah.
It's like, uses it in the purest sense, because now it's been done so much that people have to get really creative and be like, mm-hmm. they thought that this verse meant this, but actually it means this, and the demon's a goat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whereas, like, in this, it's very pure. It's very simple. It's just the Antichrist.
Yep.
You know, and here he comes.
And you need all these daggers.
So many daggers.
You have to be on these steps in the altar.
The blood has to spill all over the altar. Mm-hmm. Make a big mess.
But
we're going to go in a different direction.
Very different for next time.
And the next few times, I think.
Yes.
Perhaps.
So our next movie is, we're starting at the beginning with The Sixth Sense.
Yes.
Which is one of my all-time favorites. I don't think I've ever shown that movie to my children either.
Yeah, I can't remember if I did or not. I think we might have. Because, you know, obviously M. Night Shyamalan is a very prolific director and filmmaker, and it's kind of like, I don't know, some people don't like his stuff. I think a lot of people have kind of a groan, like, oh, another M. Night Shyamalan movie. What's this nonsense going to be about? But he is very inventive. Mm-hmm. He tells some really interesting stories, and it's like, yeah, like, oh, it's always got to have a twist or whatever. But there are a lot of his films that I really, really enjoy. And then obviously, like, The Sixth Sense was his career maker. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the one, if people have seen none of his movie or have seen only one of his movies, this is going to be the one that they've seen.
Yeah.
So we're going to start there.
We will start there. I'm a fan of a lot of his other films.
So. Yeah. So we'll scoot through some other ones too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you haven't watched it,
I mean, please, don't ask anybody about it.
What are you waiting for?
Yeah. Cause that it is, an ending, like a big surprise ending that surprised most people. I'm sure it didn't surprise Meredith.
I was like 13. Yeah, so maybe okay. I was surprised.
When it came out, it was one of those things of like, oh my God, have you seen it? You've got to go see it. Like, don't let any, like, don't, you know.
Don't talk about it.
Yeah.
It's we're lucky internet,
that like,
the
yeah, there was no Facebook for people to spoil this, you know, season finale of Game of Thrones for you.
Yeah.
But still there was like, if somebody was a jerk, like, mm-hmm. you know, they could tell you the end.
It's called the spoiler hoodie.
Yes, I love that hoodie.
Yeah, on the back it has the spoilers for different big movies and plot twists and
like
film
very
and
famous
books. Yes.
surprise endings that are all ruined on one sweatshirt.
I know, I had to like not wear it for a long time when Charlotte was reading the Harry Potters or watching the movies.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's why, like, you just put electrical tape over that spot.
Don't read this part. It's really, we'll tell you something you want to know.
We'll tell you, yeah.
Anyway, watch it or rewatch it. It's fun to rewatch.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this is fun. I'll always talk about The Omen and creepy stuff.
And it's all for you.
It's all for you. The pizza leftovers are all for you. Okay. Bye.
Bye.